and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 12th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, epidermal electronics and ecological controversy regarding an ambitious project to dam the lower Mekong River.
Plus, our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A new study published in Science this week demonstrates a technique for creating small, flexible electronics that attach to the skin without adhesives or wires and that can stretch and flex over joints in much the same way that normal skin does. The devices, thinner than a human hair and analogous to common temporary tattoos, are far less invasive than the usual approaches to rigging electronic sensors to the skin, familiar to anyone who's had an EKG. The authors think the new devices may have applications ranging from physiological monitoring and treatment to human-machine interfaces and game controllers. The paper's senior author, John Rogers, spoke with Stuart about them from his office at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign.
What we're trying to do here is to really reshape and redefine electronics, which are conventionally built on the rigid surfaces of silicon wafers, to look a lot more like the human body, and in this case, the surface layers of the skin, the epidermis in particular. And the goal is really to blur the distinction between electronics and biological tissues in ways that can provide new functionality in both healthcare and non-healthcare related applications.
These are fascinating devices. Tell me a little bit about what they're actually like, just physically.
So, you know, the devices are integrated circuits. They embed sensors and variety of semiconductor devices, active and passive devices, but configured into geometries that are unusual. So we use established materials, but they're configured into an open mesh type of design that involves devices and interconnects that are in the shape of very thin filamentary serpentine shapes. And what this forms is almost like a spider web of electronics that we then embed in a very thin and soft elastomer film such that the overall system has all of its physical properties matched to the properties of the epidermis itself. And partly as a result of that, with a very simple soft lamination process, you can integrate this class of device directly with the surface of the skin without any adhesives, straps, or penetrating pins that are used in conventional devices. And in that sense, it goes on just like a kid's temporary tattoo, and it sits there in a way that's almost mechanically invisible to the wearer.
Is it sticking on the same way a tattoo is? Tell me something about what's keeping this thing on.
What's keeping our device on are just van der Waals forces, you know, non-specific generalized adhesion forces that exist between any two surfaces. So we don't use any separate adhesives. It's really by virtue of the fact that the circuit is so thin and so mechanically compliant that it can kind of conform to the rough surface of the skin to, you know, allow adhesion in this way.
I guess these van der Waals forces are the same things that have been thought to, for example, hold a gecko on the glass or something
exactly.
like that.
Yeah, same type of thing. We're exploiting mechanical properties and geometries to optimize the strength of that adhesion force. And at the same time, because the circuit is so compliant, it reduces the kind of interfacial stresses that would otherwise drive crack opening and delamination between the device and the skin. Depending on the mode of use and the environmental conditions, you may want to add the kind of adhesives that are used in certain classes of temporary tattoos to further strengthen the adhesion. But to first order, you don't need it. You can, you know, put it on like a tattoo and it'll stay there. You bend the skin around and it doesn't flake off.
Well, I suppose beyond the issue of adhesion, though, there's the kind of second issue, which in some ways I found more remarkable, of fashioning electronics that actually acted like skin and were flexible and could deform, I guess. You touched on it, but could you talk a little bit more about how you met that particular challenge?
That is a challenge. It turns out that the ideas and the concepts to solve that challenge are actually pretty simple. Like the materials and the detailed mechanical modeling aspects get quite involved. But at an intuitive level, it's pretty simple. You think about a conventional silicon integrated circuit. It's built on the surface of a silicon wafer, and that wafer is rigid and brittle, and it's partly because the silicon mechanical properties are that way, but it's also a consequence of the fact that the wafer is relatively thick. It's maybe half a millimeter thick. And so if you think about bending mechanics, if you make anything thin enough, it becomes flexible. And in particular, the bending rigidity decreases with the cube of the thickness. So if you go from a half millimeter thick silicon wafer to a 50 nanometer thick silicon membrane, you have many orders of magnitude reduction in bending rigidity, and you also dramatically reduce the strains that are associated with bending. So that's the way you make silicon electronics and silicon-based devices floppy and flexible and stretchable. The way you create a restoring force then that's matched to the skin is you come in with classes of elastomer materials at thicknesses that are comparable to the epidermis with the same kind of mechanics. You mount the circuits on there because they're designed with this kind of open mesh spider web layout. They don't mechanically load the elastomer very much, so the overall system adopts the mechanics of the support, and those mechanics are designed explicitly to match the skin.
So I guess in thinking about what you've done, it sounds like there's nothing fundamentally new about the materials you've been using. You've just done a huge amount of work in adapting them to this problem. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, by design. That's what we've tried to do. I mean, you're highlighting a key feature, we think, of these systems, which is we have not had to go back and reinvent semiconductor materials or reinvent transistor design. We've tried to build on established knowledge on those topics that has emerged over the decades of work in the semiconductor industry and try to refashion them in ways that allow unprecedented, we think, opportunities in biointegration.
Well, let's move back to some specifics about the devices. For one, how do you power a device like this? I can see how you get it on there and make sure that it's deformable, but how do you handle the power side of it?
So power, I think, is a key question. And in this paper, we demonstrated two ideas to address that question. One is inductive powering. So we have these kind of filamentary serpentine traces that form inductive coils, essentially for wireless powering of the devices. And we've shown that we can generate those kind of coils, we can integrate them in this epidermal type of platform, and furthermore, that they can, in an efficient way, receive power from a primary coil that's brought into proximity of the device to drive LEDs and different electronic components. So we think inductive is good. That works if you only need to power up the device when you have the primary power coil nearby or in proximity. I think into the future, we'd like to add storage capacitors or even batteries into this platform. Didn't demonstrate it in this paper, but that's a topic of future work. And we think that that kind of storage capacity could also be married with the other solution to the power question that we did present in this paper, which is silicon solar cells you can embed in this way. And so you can capture energy from illuminating light. And I think, you know, in that case, being able to charge up an onboard battery over time could be an appealing way to do power.
And what about some of the applications for this? You sort of alluded to medical applications, but can you just give me a few more details of some of the applications you're envisioning for this technology?
We're most excited about applications in healthcare, wellness, and fitness. So we demonstrated a range of different kinds of electrophysiological status monitors in this paper, measuring electrical activity associated with muscle contractions, both in the throat and in the forearm, devices that can measure brain activity mounted on the forehead, and devices for monitoring the heart beating, and that involves integration on the chest. So these kind of monitors can be used to determine wellness, obviously. In the case of the neck-mounted device, the throat-mounted device, we also demonstrated that the signals we can pick up with these systems have sufficient data information content that when combined with pattern recognition algorithms can establish a human-machine interface. And in the case of the throat, you know, the obvious application there would be for people who suffer diseases of the larynx. But more generally, you can think about it as a control system for interfacing to prosthetics. In terms of more clinical related healthcare applications, we're interested in a few different areas. One is neonatal care, monitoring of premature babies, where we think this kind of technology is sufficiently non-invasive that it provides unique advantages compared to the regular stick-on patches with bulk wires because the babies are small and just aren't compatible with that kind of technology. We're also working in monitors for assessing sleep apnea, so devices that you can wear and you can sleep in an ordinary way, but at the same time monitoring all kinds of physiological processes.
So you wouldn't necessarily have to go into one of these sleep labs.
Right, and you wouldn't need to wire yourself up with cumbersome stuff that itself is disrupting sleep patterns. So those are two areas where we're just getting started, but we see a lot of potential there. And then the third one is in physical rehabilitation, where we have some ongoing work with folks at Johns Hopkins, where these devices are not used just to monitor the body, but to stimulate it. So the electrical interface works the other direction as well. And so you can stimulate muscle contractions, and we have some initial animal tests that indicate there's some appeal in doing this. The key thing about the devices that's unique compared to other technologies is it doesn't restrain the motion of the muscle, because it moves naturally with the skin, so the stimulation process is more effective.
Well, some of these are very short-term uses, but some of them seem to be things that you would imagine being in place for a longer time. If I remember correctly, we're sort of constantly sloughing off, you know, our skin cells. How long, realistically, might one of these devices remain in place?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We had touched upon it in the concluding paragraph of the paper, which is, as you point out, there's a continuous efflux and exfoliation of cells, dead cells, from the surface of the skin. So you can think of the skin almost as a cellular escalator. It's a number of different layers. Cells start at the base. They migrate towards the surface, differentiate as they do that. When they arrive at the stratum corneum layer, they die and then are flaked off. The time scale, roughly, for that full escalator process is about 2 weeks. So if your device is not actively or passively managing that sloughing process, then the residence times that you could expect to be viable would be in the sort of 1 to 2 week range. And that's where we are right now. Our technology is not dealing explicitly with that exfoliation, but I think there are wonderful opportunities for doing, you know, advanced bioengineering, incorporating new types of functionalities in these devices that would be more explicitly able to address that issue. So the devices that we have now, we envision them as things you stick on your skin, you wear them for a week or something like that. Maybe you peel it off, you reapply a new one, something like that.
John Rogers, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
John Rogers is senior author of a new paper demonstrating electronics that mimic the material properties of the epidermis. You can see video clips of the devices in action at video.sciencemag.org/videolab.
In a News Focus article this week, Science's Asia news editor, Richard Stone, writes about a controversial initiative led by the country of Laos to build hydropower dams in the lower Mekong River basin, and the ecological and economic concerns the project is raising. Here's Rich Stone.
Laos is proposing the first dam on the lower Mekong River mainstream, and the proposal for the dam is being assailed by critics who fear that it's going to disrupt the Mekong River basin and could have a very harmful effect on fisheries and food resources throughout this region.
Well, let's talk a bit about the geography here and the players. This big dam project, I guess the Xayaburi, if I'm not massacring the pronunciation,
that's perfect,
is being pushed by Laos. But this is really a very big watershed we're talking about here that might be affected, correct?
Yes, because until now, the only dams on the Mekong were on the upper Mekong on the Chinese side of the border. And these dams are expected to have a fairly large effect on the river flow. Now, the downstream countries, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Thailand, have talked about building hydropower dams on the lower Mekong for the last half century. But these dams have only become feasible because of the Chinese dams, because the Chinese dams will allow more water to flow during the dry season. That means that the dams on the lower Mekong actually now are much more economically viable.
So as opposed to the previous situation where there was a huge sort of seasonal variation in the amount of rainfall that was swelling this river, et cetera?
Yeah, so during the monsoon season, which runs about 4 months, about 75% of the Mekong flow comes during that season. So for the rest of the year, for the 8 months during the dry season, there's very little flow. So for a hydropower station to work, you do need a much more constant flow.
And I guess Xayaburi is only one of a number of other hydropower projects in this overall plan. I think a total of 12, if I remember correctly from your article. What's the rationale being put forward for these projects?
Well, for the two countries that stand to benefit most, particularly Laos, the dams could really transform very feeble economies, you know, try to give the population in these poor regions much more benefit than they currently get, because right now Thailand and Vietnam are growing at a very high pace, and the other countries in the region have tended to lag. So hydropower is seen, particularly by Laos, as a way to catch up.
And also, I suppose, to some extent by Cambodia, the other of the four countries that you think might stand to benefit here?
Yeah, so they have two dams planned as well. And so I would say that right now, to allow Laos particularly to break out of what it's currently considered a least developing nation status, the seven hydropower dams in Laos, as well as two more on the shared border with Thailand, Laos stands to gain, I think, 75% of the hydropower profit. So it's going to be a big, big boon.
And over against that, I guess, are the ecological threats that some are raising and that form, I think, kind of a linchpin of your article. Can you just take us through some of those threats?
Yeah, so people have realized that dams do come with trade-offs. And there certainly has been a lot of concern about the potential of large dams on the lower Mekong to hold back nutrients, hold back sediments. So that's one issue. And something that even the environmental impact assessment for the Xayaburi Dam, while it's been criticized quite heavily, it does note that the dam will have to be designed in a way that it allows as much nutrients to flow as possible. So that's one issue. But second issue, which the environmental impact assessment tended to give short shrift to, was the effect on fish. And you have several dozen fish which migrate up the Mekong during the dry season, and they spawn in stretches of the river in Laos. So the potential for the dam to present an obstacle for these fish is a pretty major concern right now. And so there are some large freshwater fish, for example, the Mekong giant catfish, the giant pangasius, which is also called the dog-eating catfish. These fish can reach up to 3 meters long and weigh more than 300 kilograms. So these are really, really big fish. Their numbers have been falling throughout the past 10, 20, or 30 years, and so the populations are quite low now. And some of the critics, some of the biologists, think that the populations of these large freshwater fish right now are in fairly dire straits, and the dam and the series of dams planned for the lower Mekong could be the last nail.
And this is not just a purely ecological question, it's also sort of an economic one, correct? I mean, there's a pretty substantial fishery built around this area.
Yeah, so some of the migratory fish form the basis for a fairly large fishery throughout the Mekong River Basin, and particularly the largest inland fishery in Lake Tonle Sap. So you have some forecasts of what the hydropower dams could do to the fisheries. I think from a baseline in 2000 of more than 2 million tons of fish caught that year to a decline, the worst case forecast, if all 12 hydropower projects go through, a decline of nearly 900,000 tons. So more than 40% loss in the whole lower Mekong Basin fishery.
Well, in the sidebar to your story, which was also quite interesting, you talked about the Three Gorges Dam project in China on the Yangtze River, which you suggest is sort of a cautionary tale for this Mekong River project.
That's right. I think people realized that this dam would create problems. And there was a lot of back and forth over the years since the dam was first proposed back in the 1930s or 40s about the potential harm it might do. There were certainly a lot of benefits from the dam, flood control being the major one. And so there was a lot of debate about whether the benefits would actually outweigh the costs. And some of the environmental problems that they predicted did happen. You know, they knew that the dam would affect spawning areas, and that is certainly true. But some of the other problems that they did not predict, they didn't predict the scouring downstream. So when the water flows through the dam holds back quite a bit of silt. The water coming through the turbines is fairly silt-free. This scours the downstream bank. And that effect has been much worse than people thought. And then there were other issues about water quality, too. The pollution in the Yangtze River has turned out to be much worse. And part of the problem is traced to the fact that the rivers flowing into the Yangtze upstream of the Three Gorges Dam are flowing more slowly. So this allows toxic algae to bloom, and this has created a much worse water quality issue.
So the law of unintended consequences kind of kicking in there.
Yeah. And so now, you know, the Three Gorges Dam authorities realize that they have a huge problem here, and they have unveiled a 10-year plan to try to tackle this. And the cost of the plan is estimated at around $26 billion. So huge price tag to try to deal with the problems. And certainly this is a cautionary tale for the dams being planned for the lower Mekong River.
So what are the next steps for the Mekong River dams? If I understand what I'm reading correctly, the project is now under some sort of review by a commission of the countries involved, but it sounds like it might be kind of a foregone conclusion at this point.
A lot of critics were worried that the Mekong River Commission 6-month-long review was not going to be very transparent, not going to be very robust. But a lot of people were surprised because in April, Vietnam and Cambodia particularly came out with some pretty significant concerns about the dam. And it persuaded Laos to publicly at least back off. And Vietnam called for a 10-year pause on all hydropower projects on the lower Mekong. And I believe Cambodia called for a full transboundary effects and cumulative risk assessment. So they asked for a lot more work. Now, Laos has acknowledged that more data needs to be collected. And the Lao Prime Minister told his Vietnamese counterpart in May that Laos would do this work. Now, simultaneously, construction is ongoing at the dam site. So critics are quite worried that while Laos has taken a public position that it's going to weigh the data carefully, you know, with the construction going on right now, the concern is that Laos has already basically decided that they want to build this dam.
Well, if the project does proceed, is there any way to mitigate its environmental harm?
Well, certainly there are more advanced turbine designs which are kinder to fish. There are sluice gates which can be put in dams to allow nutrients to flow more smoothly. So there are some measures which can be taken. The Xayaburi Dam is designed to have fish ladders as well. Now, the fish ladder design is basically geared towards salmon, and most of the migratory fish on the Mekong are either much larger than salmon or much smaller. So the size of the steps in the fish ladder may not be appropriate for the species that researchers hope to save there. So there's going to be a lot more work needs to be done to make the Xayaburi Dam less harmful. And there are certainly, you know, some species, some of the largest freshwater species like the Mekong giant catfish that researchers don't anticipate that you can design a fish ladder for that huge fish. So there are some effects of the dam which, if they go forward, the region might just have to live with.
Rich Stone, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Richard Stone writes about plans to dam the lower Mekong River in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. So, first off, we have a story about twins. And so, it's kind of well known how physiologically this happens. What new information is in this article?
Well, you're right, Carrie. Obviously, we know why twinning happens on a biological level. The question in this study is really, why does twinning happen on an evolutionary level? In other words, why has twinning persisted? And the reason scientists are asking this question is because there's actually a lot of problems with having twins, especially for women in developing countries. Twins tend to be born a lot smaller, a lot weaker, and a lot less healthy than single children. So there's a higher likelihood that they will die. Also, as you might imagine, women that bear twins have more complications during childbirth. And again, that is a bigger problem in developing countries where there's less access to medical care. And if you sort of go back along the human timeline, you can imagine that a long time ago, twinning would have also been difficult for women. And if something is difficult and if something tends to kill women and children, you would think that over the course of evolution, it would have been something that had been weeded out, and yet twinning persists today. And so this is all a long way of saying, why do we still have twinning when it causes a lot of problems?
So how did scientists tackle this question?
Well, in this study, scientists looked at a group of women in Gambia. And the reason they chose Gambia is there's actually a very large data set there going back to the 1950s. There's been a lot of doctors working in that area that have kept very good health records for women and for births and things like that. And all scientists need to do in this new study was to go through those records, look at women that had had twins, and then just basically try to look for trends. And what they saw was that women that had twins first and then had a single baby after that, these single babies tended to be about 226 grams heavier on average than single babies that were born when no twins were in the picture. And usually the heavier the baby, the healthier it is too. This finding wasn't so much of a surprise. Scientists had suspected that when women give birth to twins first, their reproductive tract sort of arranges itself in such a way that when babies are born later, they're actually filtered more nutrients than they would be otherwise. But the surprising finding was that researchers found that even when single babies were born before twins were born to the same mother, these single babies tended to be heavier, about 134 grams heavier on average. So there seems to be an advantage if women have twins. Even though having the twins is a disadvantage, an advantage comes when she has another baby, whether she has that baby before or after the twins.
In a way, the mother is basically being repaid for the risky ordeal that she went through.
Exactly.
And that baby went through.
Exactly. There's a sort of balancing that's going on here. Even though twinning can be negative, there seems to be some positives too. And the researchers don't exactly understand how this is happening, but they suspect a protein called IGF-1. And they know that IGF-1, when it circulates at high levels in women, can cause twinning. It has some sort of effect on the ovaries, causing them to release multiple eggs, which can lead to twinning. But it also has an effect on how much a fetus grows during development. So that could explain some of the linkage that scientists are seeing between twins being born and heavier children being born either before or after the twins are being born.
And next up, we're talking about a species of rat that is particularly toxic to its predators.
Right. Well, this is another biological mystery. This is a mystery about a rodent known as the African crested rat. And this is a, depending on your point of view, a pretty ugly or a pretty cute creature. You can check out the website and decide for yourself. But this is actually a rodent that's actually more closely related to lemmings or voles than true street rats. And the mystery is that this rat, which lives in East Africa, when it gets bit by dogs, these dogs tend to become very violently ill, and even sometimes they die. And so researchers have been trying to figure out what is killing these dogs. How is this rat, who's a fairly small creature, killing these very large dogs for the most part?
And so what is its secret?
Well, so basically what they did was they did a little Agatha Christie here, and they actually followed this rat around and tried to see if there's anything about its lifestyle that sort of explains its toxicity. And what they found was that these rats tend to gnaw on pieces of bark from an African tree known as the arrow poison tree. And this tree contains a compound called wabane, which is a chemical that overstimulates the heart muscle and can cause heart attack. It's actually a poison that East African hunters once used to poison their arrow tips, hence the name of the tree, for taking down large game like elephants. And what the researchers saw this rat doing was that it would gnaw on pieces of the bark, and then it would coat its fur in the spit after it gnawed on these pieces of bark. And so that what they think these rats are doing is basically coating themselves with this poison. And when they took a closer look at the rat, they discovered that the rat is actually pretty well built to hold on to this poison. Its hairs on its body are actually sort of like wicks for the toxin. They really draw the toxin in. And so when the rat coats itself with this wabane, it really just becomes just covered in this poison, so that anything that bites it, dogs included, are going to get very sick and possibly die.
When we think of poisonous animals, probably the first ones that come to mind are snakes, insects that sting and bite. Are there any other mammals that have evolved this defense mechanism?
Well, it's a good question. Actually, Capuchin monkeys rub themselves with millipedes to keep away mosquitoes. And that's sort of a similar behavior that you're seeing here. The difference here is that these rats aren't really trying to keep away the dogs. They're actually kind of killing the dogs. They are killing the dogs. And what's unique about this situation is that these rats are actually killing a very large predator rather than just doing something like pest control, which is essentially what the Capuchin monkeys are doing.
Well, I can only imagine how unpleasant the New York subway system would be if these things came over to North America.
Right.
And now our last story today is about an astronomical body that joins the ranks of black holes.
Right. Well, the way we sort of sold this story, Carrie, was what do the Canadian rock band Rush, Stephen Hawking, and a bright source of X-rays have in common?
I can't wait to find out.
Right. And the answer, as you sort of alluded to, is this black hole. It's a black hole named Cygnus X-1. And actually, when Rush sang about it in 1977, scientists weren't sure exactly what it was. They knew it was a powerful source of X-rays. They knew it was a few thousand light years away, and they had named it Cygnus X-1, and Rush proclaimed it a black hole in its song. Stephen Hawking, and this is where he comes in, had his doubts. This new study is not about proving that Cygnus X-1 is actually a black hole. That was actually done earlier this year when astronomers came up with much more reliable data about exactly where Cygnus X-1 was and what it actually was, and they found that it was indeed a black hole. This new study is really about what is the fate of this first black hole ever discovered.
Well, don't keep us in suspense. So what is this fate?
Well, the fate, according to some simulations, is not very positive. What the researchers have found is this black hole will swallow mass. It's already swallowing mass from this unfortunate star that's circling it. And eventually this star is going to explode, and then the black hole is going to sort of wander the universe by itself. It's a very sad story. And the way the astronomers discovered this was they actually ran some simulations, as I said, and basically what they found is that this star that's circling the black hole weighs about 19.2 suns. The black hole itself weighs about 14.8 suns, and the black hole has been probably swallowing stars for a very long time, and it's actually in the process of slurping away a lot of material from this star that's orbiting it. What the simulations show is that as the star continues to transfer more of its mass to the black hole, the two objects will slowly start moving away from each other because of both of their changes in mass. And today, their centers are about half as far apart as Mercury is from the Sun. But in the future, that distance is going to grow greater and greater until it gets to what is now the distance between the Sun and the Earth and keep on growing. And what the simulation suggests is that a couple million years from now, the star is going to explode, leaving the black hole by itself and basically going off into the cosmos alone.
And how does Einstein's theory of relativity play into this?
Well, if you want to throw Einstein into the mix as well, one possible scenario is that after the star explodes, when we say a star explodes, it doesn't just vaporize. In this case, the star could become a neutron star, which is basically a dead star that's not as extreme as a black hole, even though it still has a tremendous amount of mass. And if these two objects remain in orbit, the black hole and the neutron star, they could actually trigger the creation of gravitational waves, which are ripples in space-time that were predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity, and that observers here on Earth have been hoping to detect for a long time. So this unique pair is not only interesting because Rush sang about it and because Stephen Hawking postulated about it, but it actually could provide an important test for some ideas about gravitational waves. So there's a lot of really cool stuff going on here.
And what other news have we had this week?
Well, for Science Now, we've got a story about getting the body's own immune cells to attack cancer and how that may lead to new treatments for leukemia and other cancers. And also a story about how golf courses can aid in bat conservation. Also on Science Insider, we've got a story about women in science and why they make less than their male counterparts. Also a story about the debt agreement signed in the U.S. last week and what impact that will have on science. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat's about type 1 diabetes. What are the current treatments and what are the possibilities for future cures? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news on the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that wraps up the August 12, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.